day after President Trump's inauguration, an unprecedented gathering of women assembled in Washington, D.C., and in other cities around the country as a show of sisterly solidarity, the so-called Women's March, as I'm sure you're all aware. And this gathering demonstrated how fraught the nature of contemporary feminism is. Much could be gleaned from the list of the issues included. The platform was very diverse. The self-stated principles for which women purportedly marched included an end to violence broadly construed, universal access to birth control and abortion, LGBTQIA rights, which in their own words included the power to control our bodies and be free from gender norms, expectations, and stereotypes, workers' rights for citizens and immigrants, including pay equity for women, access to childcare and family leave, and a living wage. Also included on the platform, civil rights, disability rights, immigrant rights, and environmental justice. Apparently, only leftists can be feminists. Now, also instructive is a consideration of those women who are intentionally excluded from the event, namely pro-life feminists. Consider this for a moment. The platform of this march was so broad that it made room for every social issue of the day. But pro-life feminists were viewed to be a threat. This raises many questions. But for this evening, our question is, can there even be a Catholic feminism? But before we take up this question, let us turn our attention to feminism in its secular form. As you may know, some sociologists, philosophers, and cultural commentators have divided the history of feminism into three or four so-called waves. First wave feminism describes the American suffragists who labored for the full flourishing of women in the social sphere and whose primary goal was to obtain the vote for women. Second wave feminism took a self-consciously existentialist and later Marxist turn. Though many voices constitute this second wave, particularly figures like Betty Friedan and Shulamith Firestone, in the American context, the exemplar was Simone de Beauvoir, whose 1949 book, The Second Sex, became a handbook for the movement. In this text, de Beauvoir offers an historical genealogy to demonstrate her claim that women have always functioned as derivatives of men. Concerning the nature of women, de Beauvoir argues, and you do have this quote on your paper, "The fact is that women would be quite embarrassed to decide what she is. But this not because the hidden truth is too vague to be discerned. It is because in this domain, there is no truth. An existent is nothing other than what he does. The possible does not extend beyond the real. Essence does not precede existence. In pure subjectivity, the human being is not anything. He is to be measured by his acts." De Beauvoir's thesis here, that human beings construct themselves according to their actions absolutely, that there is no stable existence upon which they build the edifice of their lives, provides the groundwork for her famous claim that, quote, "one is not born a woman, one becomes one." Key to de Beauvoir's analysis is the constricting role that motherhood has played in the lives of women, a belief that undergirds her support of contraception and abortion. In the American context, the second wave feminism of the 60s and 70s made the legalization of abortion and access to birth control principal components of the movement. In addition, they advocated for pay equity and equality of opportunity for women in the workforce. Whether we are currently up to a fourth wave of feminism or still in the third wave is a subject of dispute. But wherever you come down on this, the figure that stands behind contemporary feminism is Judith Butler. Describing her work as an intervention in feminist theory, Butler sees herself as self-consciously standing against second wave feminism, which she perceived to be grounded in exclusionary gender norms, which delegitimize aberrant sexual proclivities. She rejects the concept of sex as it has traditionally been understood. She argues that sex, the heterosexual complementarity of bodies and of masculine and feminine identities, is a violent circumscription of reality. That's a quote, violent circumscription of reality. In its place, she substitutes the idea of gender. Gender is not predetermined by binary cultural roles or by any biological natural fact. There is no pre-cultural womaness that shapes our cultural form of woman. woman is thoroughly constructed through a sexist binary rhetorical matrix. Sex and gender, men and women, are shaped by, quote, juridical systems of power, which produce the subjects they subsequently come to represent. Butler writes, performativity is not a singular act, but a repetition and a ritual which achieves its effects through its naturalization in the context of a body, understood in part as a culturally sustained temporal duration. That's a mouthful. She says that gender is performative. What we take to be an internal essence of gender is manufactured through a sustained set of acts, posited through the gendered stylization of the body. Since what we take to be internal to ourselves is often an internalization of external acts, rather than admitting the existence of the binary distinction between genders as male and female, Butler suggests that one creates one's own gender by performing it. She writes, her/his performance destabilizes the very distinctions between the natural and the artificial, through which discourse about genders almost always operates. It has become unclear how to distinguish the real from the unreal, and this is the occasion in which we come to understand that what we take to be real, what we invoke as the naturalized knowledge of gender, is in fact a changeable and revisable reality. At this point, the sedimented and reified field of gender reality is understood as one that might be made differently, and indeed, less violently. Fourth wave feminism, if it is indeed separate from the third wave, is perhaps best represented by the recent Women's March. It fails to cohere, as the subject of the movement herself, woman, has been transposed to a completely conceptual reality. Now, despite the variegated landscape created by the different strands of feminist theory, it seems to me that we can reduce secular feminism to its extrinsic principles or acts, its intrinsic principles, and its deepest interior impulse or motivating factor. The extrinsic principles of contemporary feminism consist of the political, social, and economic results pursued by the movement, primarily free and unlimited access to birth control and abortion, pay equity, the ability to work wherever one wishes and in any capacity one desires, equal political representation, and the like. But there are also intrinsic principles that undergird the extrinsic edifice of political and social issues. These intrinsic principles of secular feminism we might call self-determination and self-expression, in the sense of a fundamental belief that reality is primarily constructive, and that any natural or rational limits to the free expression of women is a kind of violence. This constructivist viewpoint views freedom in terms of license and unlimited choice. Now, we would be remiss if we thought of this constructive, self-determinative impulse merely as a modern phenomenon. For really, it lies at the very root of American feminism. Indeed, the root of America itself, since our culture and government are based on the Lockean concept of liberty, which is license bounded only by the rights of others. But on this point, consider, for example, the suffragist Elizabeth Cady Stanton's politicized and constructivist interpretations of scripture in her Women's Bible Project. And her Women's Bible is something like Jefferson's Bible. I don't know if you know anything about that, like sort of cutting and pasting and then adding commentary. So nevertheless, only in and through second wave feminism did self-determination and self-expression come to be viewed primarily through the lens of the sexual revolution, resulting in the unfettered support of reproductive rights and gender nonconformity. Though I've identified self-determination and self-expression as the intrinsic principles of secular feminism, I would argue further that underlying these are a few unarticulated interior impulses or motivating factors, one positive, one negative. The negative interior impulse is a desire for power, for control, for domination, but ultimately for freedom. And as we have just seen, this freedom, grounded as it is in a constructivism that knows no natural limits, is understood primarily as license. But this negative interior impulse itself can, I think, be reduced to a prior positive interior impulse, which we might call simply the desire to matter. the desire to matter. Socially, yes, but by being socially, yes, by being able to contribute meaningfully in and through one's own particular talents. But more to the point, to matter existentially, to have an undeniable value at the depths of one's being. In other words, this positive interior impulse is the desire to be free in the authentic sense, a desire that is coextensive with human nature itself. And here, we have uncovered an opening for a truly Catholic feminism. Catholic feminism, like its secular counterpart, can be understood in terms of a threefold taxonomy of extrinsic principles, intrinsic principles, and interior impulse. Pope John Paul II has written eloquently about the role of women in church and society, and the characteristic feminine virtues and dispositions that make up what he called the feminine genius. Principal amongst these is a certain disposition of receptivity, grounded phenomenologically in the capacity for motherhood and finding its perfection in the receptivity to grace. Taking this as our point of departure, we can say that Catholic feminism is grounded in a metaphysical realism that comes to expression in both an ontological and a theological conception of receptivity, that is, receptivity to being and receptivity to God. We are aided in our understanding of these concepts by the writings of the great Catholic theologian of the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas. To come to grips with an ontological account of receptivity, we begin with St. Thomas's revival of Aristotle's real distinction between act and potency. According to both Aristotle and Aquinas, every finite being is composed of both act and potency, of ways in which it is, its existence, and of ways in which it could be, its essence, which is actualized by its existence. Aristotle formulated this distinction as a way to navigate the impasse between two pre-Socratic thinkers, Parmenides and Heraclitus, both of whom inquired into the nature of change and the nature of being. A little heavy on the philosophy here, stick with me. All right? Parmenides argued that nothing that is could change, because everything that is being, and being is complete. So our senses deceive us when they perceive change. Heraclitus, by contrast, argued that all was in motion. He is said to have said, "You can never step into the same river twice. All is becoming." And so being and becoming here are opposites. Completely the same, all the time, complete, changing. For Heraclitus, the distinction between being and non-being, so being and nothing, is a distinction in language only and not in reality. Since becoming or change has within it its own sufficient reason for existing, being and non-being are really one thing for Heraclitus. And if you're thinking that this sounds a lot like some modern ideas, you'd be correct. And if you're thinking, what is she talking about? Well, I understand that too. So Aristotle inserts in the being non-being binary the transitional state of potency. Everything that we experience consists in ways in which something is, being, act, and the ways in which it could be, potency, the potential. Act, as we have said, corresponds to existence, the way a thing is in reality. Potency denotes a capacity to receive being. Things really do undergo change. They move from potential to actual. But this cannot be done on the basis of potency alone, which is not a sufficient condition for change. A thing changes only when an external agent acts upon it. The question raised is this: are there no limits to change? Isn't a thing potentially anything? No. Because for St. Thomas, as for Aristotle before him, potentiality is rooted in a thing's nature as it actually exists. This is called realism. We do not simply construct reality. This real distinction between act and potency underlies much in the metaphysics of St. Thomas. But for our purposes, let us draw out the significance for our understanding of the body and soul of the human person. The soul, purely immaterial and therefore incorruptible, is the act of the body. Expressed in the terms that we have just been using, the soul is act to the potency of the body. Looked at another way, the body individuates the soul. And yet, in some way, the soul is, in a sense, receptive also to the body. For the body provides the limits within which the soul operates. It informs the soul and mediates the world to it. Thus, even in death, when the soul is separated from the body, but prior to the general judgment, when they're reunited, the soul is still my soul and not someone else's. It remains individuated. Our bodies, as they are given to us, that is, as sexed, and the choices that we make in and through them have consequences also for our souls. There is a reciprocal relationship. Nobility of soul will express itself in nobility of body. An example of this is something like the clarity of the physical eye of the saint. Consider St. Gemma Galgani in this regard, and I gotta just say, Google her. Her eyes are crazy. St. Gemma Galgani. I mean, it's just like saint eyes. Anyway, so consider St. Gemma Galgani in this regard, whose purity of soul seems to radiate from her very eyes. Also, the lived experience of the body marks the soul as well. Here we might call to mind Oscar Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Dorian Gray has a portrait of himself, a kind of body that ages in his place and acts as an exterior record of his hedonistic lifestyle. And his image is diminished with each sin that constitutes his moral corruption. Our overall point in drawing on an analysis of act and potency is to demonstrate that though human nature is one thing, complementarity in the body, the distinction between the sexes, informs the soul in some real way and makes our souls ours, unique, and analogously, sexed. Catholic feminism finds freedom in this basic datum of reality precisely because freedom always operates within the limits of nature. Thus, self-determination can never be taken as an absolute. Self-determination cannot consist of a pure constructivism, but rather as a surrender to what we may call the givenness of being, to metaphysical realism. In its Christian form, this realism expresses a confidence and a trust in the world as God has made it, a fundamental trust in being itself, which is at the same time a fundamental trust in truth, goodness, and beauty. Reality must be the limit of our every operation. And, contrary to many secularists, the limits of realism are not a straitjacket, but rather the fruitful domain in which freedom can truly operate. A truly Catholic feminism must take as an intrinsic principle the givenness of being, of reality, of our own being, and of the being of others. Surrendering to the givenness of being ultimately means recognizing that reality comes to us as gift and is not our own constructive project. We must receive being. We must love it as it is given. This surrender to the givenness of being takes place under a twofold aspect of love, desire, and possession. We desire being, and as knowers, we are receptive to it, which acts upon our knowing even as an agent acts on a patient, to use St. Thomas's language. And yet we already have being to some degree. We are always already in possession of being, even though it is not perfected in us. Taking these ideas together, we can say that by surrendering to the givenness of being, we desire and love being, that being which presents itself to us in truth. We are speaking here, therefore, of a fundamental openness to being, of receptivity. Receptivity refuses to dominate. More precisely, it refuses to construct being. It refuses to impose one's own will on being. Instead, it is content to receive being, and this in proper relation. In this sense, objectivity, that is, allowing being to present itself to us rather than imposing one's own thought or will on the object, subjectivity, which is common to projects of constructivism, is, feminist theorists notwithstanding, the opposite of violence. It is humility. It is non-dominance. It is love. Now we turn to a theological account of receptivity. We have already uncovered the interior impulse of Catholic feminism, freedom in the authentic sense. This freedom is found only in conformity to Christ, who alone fulfills the deepest need of the human spirit to be free. Before we proceed to consider this, we must pause and sort of zoom out for a moment, because we've begun our discussion in medias res. For Catholic feminism holds in view precisely what secular feminism avoids articulating, the final goal for which we are striving. And this avoidance is certainly symptomatic of our very materialistic times, which seems satisfied with constant action and activism, but which remains untethered by any unifying endpoint that would hold together our actions and make them purposeful. In other words, if you ask secular feminists what their ultimate goal is, they would most likely name any of the elements that we have identified as extrinsic principles. But the question remains, then what? I am paid as much as my male counterparts. And then? I am free to dissipate my life in endless hookups and have abortion readily available to me so that I need not worry about the consequences of my actions. And then? I have made of myself whatever I wished and conformed to no one else. And then? And then we die. We must therefore first ask the question, what are we aiming at? What is our goal? Aristotle puts it best when he says that all human beings desire happiness. And in fact, a chief characteristic of our human nature is that we are oriented towards not only happiness, but perfect happiness as our final end. To some extent, when we seek the deepest interior impulse of the feminist movement, we really could simply say, to be happy. Of course, human conceptions of happiness vary, as St. Thomas notes when he takes up Aristotle's reflections on the matter. But the thing about human beings who are created in the image and likeness of God is that we are not satisfied by any limited fleeting good. Our ultimate good must be something lasting, something immaterial, something universal, something perfect. Though some would take power or money or honor or pleasure to be the highest good and the goal towards which their whole life is oriented, these things cannot constitute our ultimate and final good. We can never rest in these goods. We can never really possess them, though in some sense they often possess us. Money, after all, cannot be possessed after death, and even in this life it is only a means to an end. The pleasures of the senses last only a moment. Honor and power are never actually possessed at all. St. Thomas astutely observes that honor is really only the opinion of others about your virtue and value, and therefore they own it, not you. And by power, one directs other people towards their goal, but not oneself. So both honor and power are only derivative goods anyway. None of these things are suitable goals for one who has the dignity of being created in the image of God, with an intellect and a will. Human beings are built for a lasting good, a good that constitutes the fulfillment of our own perfection. St. Thomas writes, quote, "It is impossible for any created good to constitute man's happiness, for happiness is the perfect good which lulls the appetite altogether, else it would not be the last end. If something yet remained to be desired. Now the object of the will, that is, of man's appetite, is the universal good, just as the object of the intellect is the universal true." So emphasis here on universal. "Hence it is evident that naught can lull man's will save the universal good. This is to be found not in any creature, but in God alone, because every creature has goodness by participation, whereas God alone can satisfy the will of men. Therefore, God alone constitutes man's happiness." So God alone is the object of our happiness. He's the final end of all our actions. All human decisions and actions play out against the horizon of God as our final end, at least implicitly. The natural knowledge and love of God as the only suitable end for human beings is discernible through reason alone. Both Plato and Aristotle discovered through reason that some kind of contemplation of the good, in the case of Plato, or of the uncaused cause, in the case of Aristotle, was the ultimate goal of human life, though they could not work out the details of this. They understood that the human person naturally desires the vision of God. But reason, enlightened by faith, tells us that our goal is not simply an abstract awareness of the first cause mediated through creatures, but rather that it lies in the possession of God. And in fact, among earthly beings, only human beings are created for true happiness, because happiness consists in possessing God. Possessing God. Granted, all of creation moves towards God as its final end. Lower creatures, what the tradition has called the vestigia Dei, the vestiges of God, where we see the traces of God, can have a sort of participated likeness of God in their mere existence, in the case of mineral, or rocks, you know, or in their animation, plants, or in their knowing and affect, animals. But only the human being, created in the image of God, bears in his own rational soul the capacity to possess God forever in heaven, to make God our own, to make our happiness our own happiness. And this possession we call the bond of charity or love. Only the vision of God can satisfy our intellect. Only the perfect bond of charity can perfect our will. It should be obvious to us that such a lofty goal, though really being a natural desire on the part of human beings, is in no way naturally attainable. This final possession of God, that is, the love of God, can come to us only as a supernatural gift, can only be received by us as grace. At this point, we might seem somewhat far afield from our considerations on Catholic feminism, but stick with me. We're preparing the foundation for the return to our theme. Okay, take a water, dive back in. All right, let's go. Okay, so what is this supernatural love that we receive and that we possess completely as our final end? In the 20th question of the first part of the Summa, which takes up the question of whether or not God loves all things, St. Thomas writes, "The love of God infuses and creates goodness." The love of God infuses and creates goodness. God's love for us actually puts love in us, raises us to the status of being lovable and of loving in return. Now, God's love is unlike human love in this regard. Creation itself is an act of God's creative love. When we say that God loves all of creation, and particularly us, it is always with this in mind. God's love creates goodness and love in the beloved, whereas our love only beholds what is lovable in another, affirms it, and desires that it be preserved, or wishes a greater good be given to another. God literally causes us to be lovable and to be capable of loving in return. He raises us up to the level of love. There's a great mystery here. As St. Thomas puts it, God's love is the cause of the goodness in things. And this holds also for the final cause. This metaphysical statement can be transposed to the moral order. God's love causes the soul to be conformed to him and capable of fulfilling his holy will. Now, charity, or love, St. Thomas says, is a gift created in the will by that uncreated charity which loved us first and which constantly preserves, vivifies, and recreates our love. Certainly, we live in a world where there are many definitions of love, not all of which are true. But the love that we receive in a truly supernatural infused virtue comes from God and tends towards God. We cannot make it for ourselves. It must be given. It must be received. St. Thomas says that by this divine gift of charity, we first love God, the author of grace, for his own sake, by which, too, I love myself and then my neighbor, because he or she is like me, is loved by God, and is called to glorify God both here and in eternity. Thus we see that love is primarily God-directed. It is supernatural friendship. And friendship, St. Thomas says, building on Aristotle, is a love of mutual benevolence, founded on life in common, a life which is a participation in God's own inner life, a life which enables us to see him without medium, to love him without end. So the essence of supernatural love is to love God and his goodness for its own sake, not simply in gratitude for what he has given us, but with a love that desires eternal life, because by attaining heaven, we best glorify God. Love in its truest form is always something supernatural. Now, what does St. Thomas mean when he says that in love, we see God without medium? The answer to this will get us closer to understanding freedom. For he means this: when we love God, we love him directly, in and through his love for us. This is the real immediacy of love. And this love is different than knowing things about God. When we know things, anything, whether about God or the world around us, there's always something in between ourselves and the knowing, our own senses. We perceive things through our senses and then reflect on them in knowledge or judgment. But love is not like that. Love is immediate. Knowledge begins with the world and moves towards knowledge of God. So we conceptualize it, and then we come to know something about God. Love begins with God, who infuses us with his love, which then moves outward to the world. It is exactly the opposite dynamic. Unmediated love of God, then, describes the heart truly possessed by God in love, in grace, and confirmed in the total possession of God in glory. Another way to say this is that charity unites. It unites lover and beloved, conforming the one to the other. The immediacy of love opposes distance. Thus, the immediacy of God's love can be the only real foundation for our freedom. With our sights fixed firmly on our supernatural end, as this runs away from me, we see that conformity to God, conformity to Christ, in whose hypostatic union we have displayed the truth of what it means to be truly human, shows us who we are at our core, what value we have as human beings and as women. This interior impulse provides a suitable basis for any project of Catholic feminism. Let us then draw out the significance of this by identifying some intrinsic principles of Catholic feminism. We too can accept self-determination and self-expression as intrinsic principles, but with this caveat. These two must always be understood in terms of conformity to our identity in Christ. I said earlier that only human beings in the earthly order are truly free and are therefore self-determining. We can choose happiness for ourselves, whereas the lower creatures cannot. But for our freedom to really have its truly human character, it must reflect the freedom we find in Christ. What did freedom look like in the incarnate Christ? Here St. Paul comes to our aid in the ancient Christian hymn found in Philippians 2. Quote, "Have the mind among yourselves which was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God something to be grasped at, but rather emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself, becoming obedient even unto death, death on a cross. Therefore God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every other name, so that the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." This is the great hymn of the kenotic Christ, kenosis means self-emptying in Greek, which many of us heard just last week. In this passage, we see an image of freedom that is grounded in receptivity, humility, and surrender to the will of God. What do I mean by this? In what way was Christ receptive? In what way does this receptivity relate to freedom? This passage from Philippians pivots on the relationship between humility and exaltation. Christ empties himself in taking on our human nature in the hypostatic union. Concerning this, St. Thomas writes, quote, "How beautiful to say that he emptied himself, for the empty is opposed to the full. For the divine nature is sufficiently full because every perfection or goodness is there. But human nature and the soul are not full, but capable of fullness, because it was made as a slate not written upon. Therefore, human nature is empty. Hence, he says he emptied himself because he assumed a human nature." Several things to note here. First, Christ, who is the fullness of truth in every perfection, by taking on our nature, becomes empty precisely because human nature and the soul are not full, but capable of fullness. We see that our nature has a passive capacity for its perfection. It is receptive to perfection. In other words, we do not bear within ourselves our own perfecting principle. As we have said earlier, we must receive our perfection. We cannot construct it. Second, note the language that St. Paul uses. Christ did not deem equality something to be grasped at. This stands in contradistinction from our first parents, who in fact illegitimately grasped at divinity when tempted to become like gods. Christ, the new Adam, undoes this first sin by opposing the pride of our first parents with his own deep humility, their willfulness with his own surrender to his Father's will. Thus, St. Thomas writes, "The manner and the sign of Christ's humility is obedience, whereas it is characteristic of the proud to be self-willed." So Christ sees his humility even to the end, to his redemptive death on the cross. But the key to this passage is that the exaltation of Christ, every knee shall bow, does not happen despite his death on the cross, but is rather consequent upon his ignominious death. It is precisely because of his receptivity to grace in his human nature, his humility, his self-surrender, that he reigns as king, which is signified by the act of genuflection. Every knee shall bow. And if you were to take a look at the text in the Greek, there is a parallel between the kenosis, the self-emptying of Christ, and the proskenesis, literally genuflection, which is what one does before the king. St. Thomas sees in this passage a model for our own lives. And I would argue that we find here a model particularly for Catholic feminism, rooted in this characteristic feminine disposition of receptivity. St. Thomas writes, quote, "It should be noted that we should have the mind of Christ Jesus in five ways, according to the five senses. First, to see his glory, so that being enlightened, we may be conformed to him. Second, to hear his wisdom in order to become happy. Third, to smell the grace of his meekness, that we may run to him. Fourth, to taste the sweetness of his mercy, that we may always be in God. Fifth, to touch his power, that we may be saved." End quote. Can we not see in St. Thomas's analysis of Philippians 2 fruitful intrinsic principles for Catholic feminism, a feminism whose interior impulse is authentic freedom? Following St. Thomas's reflection, we find that authentic freedom operates within the limits set by God to hear his wisdom. It is oriented towards God as our final end, meekness, that we may run to him. It is a freedom that is merciful and therefore person-centered rather than utilitarian, to taste the sweetness of his mercy. And finally, it is a freedom which receives its power from God rather than illegitimately grasping for it, to touch his power, that we may be saved. We've covered a good bit of ground here this evening, but what does all of this mean practically? Here, we can begin to spell out some of the extrinsic principles of Catholic feminism. First, Catholic feminism must be person-centered. In his letter to women, Pope John Paul II writes, quote, "Progress usually tends to be measured according to the criteria of science and technology. Nor from this point of view has the contribution of women been negligible. Even so, this is not the only measure of progress. Nor, in fact, is it the principal one. Much more important is the social and ethical dimension, which deals with human relations and spiritual values. In this area, which often develops in an inconspicuous way, beginning with the daily relationships between people, especially within the family, society certainly owes much to the genius of women." End quote. This is perhaps the most important contribution that women can make in the public sphere, to always hold in view persons and not simply numbers or calculations. This is probably a provocative statement at MIT. Mental note. Okay. But the point here is not that women should be unconcerned with numbers. Of course you should be, because this too is a reflection of reality. The point is that women have a particular gift, and this is corroborated by the science, do with it what you will, of seeing the whole rather than the part. Seeing the whole allows us to see the implications of calculative reasoning, its consequences for persons, its dangers and its joys. In other words, women humanize things wherever we go, and we should not shy away from this. It is an extension of our capacity for motherhood, which is not strictly a biological reality. Second, because Catholic feminism is person-centered, it is also grounded in mercy. Mercy never sees human beings in terms of expediency. For this reason, Catholic feminism can never reduce a child to a problem to be medicated into oblivion through birth control or disposed of via abortion. Third, Catholic feminism respects and delights in the limits of nature, of being. This includes a recognition of the essential complementarity of women and men, eschewing the need to reduce human beings to a single expression, that of men. The being of women is a vital, necessary, and intended expression of God's glory. Receptivity to the givenness of reality, to an acceptance of sexual difference, does not necessarily mean that women have no capacity to do many of the same things that men do. It does, however, indicate that perhaps women will approach things differently. Again, we draw on Pope John Paul II, who writes, "Woman has a unique capacity to see the person as an individual, to understand his aspirations and needs with special insight, and she is able to face up to problems with deep involvement." And so a greater capacity for problem solving that can hold many tasks in view at the same time is a part of the feminine genius. The suitable embrace of classic feminine virtues, particularly of receptivity, as we have underscored in the life of Christ. And I would say here that receptivity is only a liability if we accept with all forms of secular feminism that domination is the goal of human flourishing. In the absence of this goal, however, we can see the value, I think, of receptivity. A fourth extrinsic principle is that Catholic feminists, grounded in the true vision of the human person and of the nature and value of women in particular, should seek to implement real social improvement consistent with that vision. We must advocate for economic and social equity, but not because we need to dominate or because we measure our self-worth by these things. The final end of these efforts must not be our own aggrandizement, but a true spirit of charity for those who are served by our social roles, our families, our children, and the world at large. We must uphold the absolute dignity of each and every person, particularly the unborn, the marginalized, and those viewed by others as imperfect. We must work for the end of the medicalization of pregnancy through contraception, because pregnancy is not a disease, but the actualization of the potency given in our very nature. To conclude, Catholic feminism ultimately begins with God as its first principle, God as our first cause and final end. It holds in view reality as it has been structured by God and our cooperative role in it. Though it is very easy to be absorbed in the material realities of life, the Catholic feminist can never forget the reason for our being, which is simply this: to be conformed to Christ, to find our identity in Christ, and to take the freedom found in Christ as our point of departure for all of our efforts in the social sphere. The end. All right, questions. What do you got for me? Yes.
You touched on at the beginning of the talk the inclusion in sort of the secular feminism of also like LGBTQ issues. So how would a person who's trying to bring Catholic feminism into the world talk about that? And
like LGBT?
Yeah, I think specifically what I want to ask about is people, how do we define woman as not this a gender thing, because a lot of people are pushing for what if I'm born in a man's body but I feel like a woman? Mm-hmm. What if I have the organs of a man but I feel like a woman?
Right.
Or I have it,
So the thing is this, and this is actually really the substance of this talk, and the substance of what I mean by receptivity and the givenness of being. Reality doesn't come from us, it comes from God, and we don't construct it. Now, does this mean that we don't change things? Of course we do change things. I mean, obviously, you're in a university that is changing all sorts of things, hopefully for the good, in many, many spheres. So that's not the point. But the point is, there is a basic givenness of being. Women are women, men are men, from the point of view of our Catholic faith. Now, do all women struggle? Yes. Do all men struggle? Yes. Do we have fallen human nature? Yes. But we can't separate ourselves from that basic givenness of our being. Now, I talked about the complementarity of the sexes, and I want to talk about that a little bit. What I mean is this. So when we think about what a human being is, I said a human being is made in the image and likeness of God. We have a soul and we have a body. And I said that places us, in some sense, in the center of God's creation. We have spiritual realities. God, infinite spirit, angels, spirit alone. We have earthly realities, animal, plant, and mineral. Animals, plants have souls, actually, to make them animate. They're like alive. We alone are the earthly people with the body, with the affect, with the intellect, and with the will. And in some sense, that's a unitive thing. Every one of us is simply that by virtue of our nature, intellect and will. And in some sense, that's spirit. It doesn't have a sex. But at the same time, to be a human being is to have a spirit that's always given in a body. So lots of people make jokes about St. Thomas and scholastics in the Middle Ages talking about angels, and why are they always talking about angels? Well, this is actually one of those reasons why they're talking about angels. Because angels, as pure spirit, don't have any bodies. So what they are as an individual is only their spirit. But human beings, because we have bodies, our souls and bodies always go together. Notice that I said that in death, death is simply the separation of the soul and the body. Now, simply, the separation of the soul and the body. That's a very fearsome thing, and this is why we fear death, because souls and bodies go together. They're not meant to be separated. So in what way does the soul and the body go together? The body informs the soul. The very body that we have, in some sense, gives our soul content. Our soul doesn't experience the world, doesn't experience God, doesn't experience other people, has no relationship with anything, including itself, interiorly, or anything outside of itself, except in and through the body in which we've been given. And that's the way it's meant to be. Why is it the way it's meant to be? Because it's been given. I don't create myself, and I don't take myself out of the world. even if I killed myself, I don't take myself out of the world. Why? Because we have an immortal soul, which still continues to live forever. So I am not the person that brings myself into being. I am not the person that takes myself out of being. In fact, it can't be done once I'm brought into being. My role then, and this is a true human role, is to receive that being as I've been given. That's the sort of theological point about that. Now, personally, what you do is charitable conversations. I mean, obviously, people are people, and everybody's working with something. I mean, that's not working with... I mean, everybody literally is working with something difficult. That's not necessarily anything more difficult than anything else people are working with. I think the real bond of friendship is a wonderful thing. Does that help at all, or is there a more specific question in this? Go ahead if there's a more specific question.
I guess, like, how do I talk to a friend who really wants to identify as a woman, and how do I help them with that?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you do is you love them. I mean, love is never the wrong answer here. But, I mean, it isn't, right? But I don't want to be simplistic about that. Love is never the wrong answer, but love does not always mean the acceptance of bad choices. Love wants what's best for the other person. Love wants that person to be oriented towards their good. That's fundamentally what love is. Love can never be oriented towards diminishing a person. Now, it does diminish a person to do something in their life that's contrary to the will of God for them. But we all do this, and we call it sin. So how do we deal with the sin of every person? We love them, and when we can, we speak truth to them. But oftentimes, love is the better approach to truth than preaching. Which is great coming from the dogmatist, of course. I mean, I just sit here telling dogma, but I mean, so if I'm knocking on my door, I'm sorry, I'm going to be like, well, let's just look at the sumo. But no. But for normal people, I don't want to say acceptance of lifestyles. I think acceptance of the person as created in the image and likeness of God and that relationship of love honestly has to come first. But that doesn't mean when asked or pressed or when you can, you shouldn't give the Catholic view, because I think you should, because a person has the right to hear it, that they're loved exactly as they are, and as they are is exactly as they've been given, and that they have to work some stuff out. But again, I want to put this in a category of we all have to work some stuff out. We sometimes in each age, we sort of have like these like meta issues or like these meta sins, like somehow that's like, oh, that's the sin. And like everything else, you know, the rest of us can just sort of like, you know, rest on our laurels because, hey, I'm not having that problem. No. So, I mean, I think that's something. Yeah.
Okay, I actually have two questions.
Sure.
So first question, you mentioned that like soul started out as blank slates or like something to that.
The tabula rasa in St. Thomas, which is not the same as the block. Okay.
Okay. And I was just wondering if that's like the view that the theology you've studied supports, or if the souls also influence the body.
Okay, number one, the soul definitely, okay, so when St. Thomas talks about a tabula rasa, he's not talking about what, like, the empiricists are talking about as a tabula rasa. So, the empiricists, we're actually a blank slate. What do I mean by empiricists? So, in the history of Western philosophy, we take a turn, okay, I gotta do this really quick, because otherwise I'll just be, for the next 30 minutes, talking to you about Western philosophy, but just take part. We move from things outside of ourselves to we perceive things primarily subjectively. We're going to jump to how this sort of plays out. We end up with like empiricists and rationalists. Rationalists are all like, okay, everything I know is somehow interiorly in me, one way or another. And you can actually ask Father about this because he has like a degree in philosophy, so he knows all this. So my slipshod thing here, you can get some backup. But then you end up with the empiricists, for whom everything is absorbed through observation. Everything comes through observation. We have like sort of no preceding knowledge except for sort of what we take in observationally. It's kind of like a super reduced sense of scientific method, sort of abstracted to the existential. St. Thomas is an Aristotelian. Now, what do I mean by that? It means everything we know comes through knowledge of the senses, but this is held together with our basic givenness of being. We are created in the image and likeness of God from, like, word one. Point of conception, image and likeness of God, which means that we have an intellect and will. That's what that means, because God is spirit. So we have an intellect and will. We have the capacity to know and love. That's always already given to us. We also have certain first principles of knowing. That's always already given to us. But then there's all of this experiential knowledge that we take in through our senses. And when we sense things, that's perception. I see red. I see gray. This is hard. I sit on it. I take that into my mind. Now, how do I end up knowing that that's a chair? Well, I don't take the chair into my head, obviously, because knowledge is not a physical thing. So I form an immaterial concept of this, right? And then I make a judgment about that immaterial concept, about the reality, sort of that chair. That's what he means by blank slate, that we have the ability to have actual sense knowledge, meaningful contact with the world outside of ourselves, and therefore that we can have objective knowledge. I can actually know the thing in itself. It's not completely subjective. This is contrasted with Plato, and then later, idealistic schools. Well, that's more information than you need, but Plato's an idealist, not like all the other idealists that come after him, because he still says we can have objective knowledge, but bracket that. Knowledge comes primarily interiorly, from inside. What was your actual question?
That was the first
question. Did I get it? By the time I get to the end, you have to refresh my memory.
Okay. Yeah.
I said it sooner. I have 4 children, so yeah. I don't have a memory anymore.
Okay. So
more
relevant.
Okay.
Let's see. So I was just wondering, what can the Catholic Church do to improve like confidence in young women? Because I feel like that's the main, coming to college, I noticed that's the main issue.
That's
that kind of results in premarital, like, as you said, like, constant hookups, it's like a general lack of confidence. And I definitely feel like the sources of confidence I've gotten have not come necessarily from the traditional church.
That is a good question. I'm not sure I have an answer. Let me think about that for 1 second. Let's see if we can come up with something. That's a very good question. I mean, I guess on the one hand, you have to be firmly convicted of your value. And that your value comes primarily from God. Actually, essentially from God. Not primarily. Essentially. It comes essentially from God. I mean, I think you have to know who you are and where you're going. I mean, I think that's the fundamental point. So, I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know, like, pastorally speaking, what specifically the church should do to gain confidence. But the one thing I would like to see would be, like, serious preaching on... and teaching on just that inherent value that you have, the inherent dignity that you have as a person and specifically as a woman. That's very general, though. I don't know.
Yeah, because I was, like, wondering if it would take... because it would be, like, definitely a different approach than the church. You know? It would be, like, as you said, more of, like, a humanistic, like, feminine approach to addressing, the, like, more of, like, a social issue.
I mean, I feel like that's what John Paul II did, like, in his whole Mulieris Dignitatum and his letter to women... I mean, I feel like, he's known as a personalist, actually. He's a Thomistic personalist. And, I mean, his whole point is to kind of focus on what it means to be a person and then how the story plays out in your daily reality. He might be a good person to look up, though. But specifically, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I don't know where the crisis of, well, you know, okay, let me put all my cards on the table. I never thought about the hookup culture as a crisis of confidence.
Yeah, it's
I just presumed it was a crisis of morality.
No, I think that
for me is interesting. I just haven't reflected on that. I just presume people have different moral values. So I've just never thought about it as a crisis of confidence.
Yeah, like definitely like coming to college, that's really what it came down to. Like for me, like when things like all of college comes at you, it really comes down to like how much do you like know yourself? And like as my friends are like MIT especially, because you realize you're not the smartest. At all, and there's like everyone is super talented, so it, like it becomes really easy to just like feel flattered and like just buy into like the first person who finds you attractive, but like
yeah,
you
see,
have to have the confidence to
yeah.
just like no, like
I'm gonna go back to who you are and where you're going, even though that's not like the most practical answer. The thing I was saying about Thomas and Aristotle on our end, it can't be honor, it can't be the opinion of other people about you because it ends. I mean, the one thing you cannot control is what other people think about you. I mean, at all. I mean, it's great if people think you're awesome, but, like, I mean, that just dissipates. I think we all know how quickly that can dissipate, you know? You can't count on those things. So, that I mean, you have to think about sort of what are the things you can really count on? Do you really want to rest your identity, not you, like collective you, rest your identity on, you know, things that just pass away so easily? I don't know. Yeah. Thank you for raising the point, though. Think about it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about complementarity, which I'm totally down with, but I think that there are things that our society society tacks onto that that are not part of what complementarity actually means. And I found, because like I consider myself a Catholic feminist, and I found in Catholic circles when you're like I don't think what you think complementarity means is actually what it means, because like you think it means the men need to like go build things and drink whiskey and like we're gonna go make cake and giggle.
Craft whiskey. 2017 is gonna be craft whiskey, but no.
So I guess how can we be a voice of like what complementarity actually means in the church? Because I think sometimes when we ascribe too many of these traditional stereotypes, that's part of what drives people into like this gender confusion.
I think that's
like, I'm not like that. Like, okay, I'm not that sort of man, so I must not be a man. So like, how do we?
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. And I do think it's like kind of a tough nut to crack. I think this is why I centered this talk actually on this receptivity piece. Because I think sometimes when we hear, even when I hear other Catholics talk about complementarity, it just seems like a very small box that I don't personally fit into. So I was joking with the people at dinner that I have a daughter. I have three sons and a daughter. They're 7, 7, 5, and 3. And my daughter's 5. And she is this little bundle of pure, like, stereotypical girliness. And I wonder where she came from. because she's not like her mother. like, honestly, I mean, she is like every stereotype you could, I mean, just this little bundle of girliness, you know? And that's who Emma is. That's who she is, you know? That's not who her mother is, actually. I'm very analytical. I'm not that. So oftentimes we hear that sort of complementarity language. It always sounds like you have to be very soft and sensitive, and I was joking, floral. You know? I'm not soft, I'm not sensitive, I'm not floral, but I'm a woman, right? So, yes, I don't think we want to equate complementarity specifically with, like, overdo it with certain kinds of just cultural characteristics, because certainly what we know is that women in different cultures do this woman thing differently, and that's a very real thing, too. But I do think we want to look at certain sort of existential realities. And that is why I went to sort of the foundational level. Because I do think it matters that we have women's bodies in the world. I honestly think it's an embodied point. I think that a woman's body and a woman's capacity for motherhood, actually, which is like, you know, the sort of verboten topic. But I think that women's capacity for motherhood can be read back a bit existentially or ontologically to some deep characteristics. I do think, generally speaking, and there's always exceptions, women do tend to care about people and not reduce them to expediency or statistics. I think there's a place, by the way, for statistics. I mean, I feel like I'm like, this is the, okay, the humanities person is going to come in and be like, you math people. I'm speaking math and now you're going to pay. No. You're speaking math. And perhaps you paid. I don't know. But there's a place for that. And there's a place for mathy women. But there's a place for, I promise I'm going to answer your question. Yeah. I want to say, like, you don't want to, there's a place for women to be women, strong and smart, without the criteria for their evaluation being purely male. And I think that's still what we're dealing with, that all of the criteria for the evaluation of women is still male, and so we don't place value in or see the gift of things that are fundamentally, I think, feminine. Like that receptivity, like mercy.
Some of my question, though, is like, I think there's certain pockets of the church that are like beautiful holy places, but where the things that women are valued on are very explicitly the floral feminine box.
I have a lot of people like that, but I do think there's a strong subset.
Yeah.
I think there's a strong subset of the floral. I don't know how much, I mean, do you see that coming from the church or just from people in the church?
From people in the church. I mean, it's like a, like, we're fallen kind of
problem. Okay,
so
the
people, like,
in the church, I think the best way to deal with that is actually just be yourself. I mean, I love that I just, like, you know, gave you, like, a 45-minute talk, which could really be, you know, reduced to be yourself. I mean, the self that God gave you. If God wanted every woman to be plural, then we'd all be plural. But that's not actually the case. It's like, no offense to people who love florals, by the way. Again, I have a lot of them. But if God wanted us to to make our contributions in the world by being primarily, I mean, these are externals. These things like aren't important. But I do think people are important. And so I think we don't want to have like sort of a bad reaction to the overdone plural so that we move so far in the opposite direction that we forget our own humanity and our own capacity to humanize. I mean, I don't think that's a good idea. But honestly, I think you being you is actually probably a better sort of preaching of the gospel to the subset, personally. Yes.
So thank you for the talk. It was very interesting. If I followed you correctly, mm-hmm. you've been very critical at some point. You've been very critical of some aspects of secular feminism.
Yeah.
And especially you came back a lot of times on the idea of the discussion on abortion versus the pro-life
yeah.
movement.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I've always identified myself as a feminist.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really manage to recognize myself in the image that you gave of it, for example,
okay.
the Women's March.
Okay.
So I was wondering, why do you consider the pro-life movement?
Uh-huh.
You talked about pro-life feminists.
Yes.
That was an interesting term. I'm wondering, why do you consider all this discourse on abortion as being part of the feminist movement?
Okay, so I took my point of departure specifically from the recent Women's March. And the principles that I read in the very first beginning of this talk are the very principles that I listed literally from the website that organized
yeah.
that. Now, I have a lot of friends who are pro-life feminists. I don't march. Because I can't. I don't have time. But, that's not like an integration. I think marching is a wonderful thing. I just personally can't do that. You know, my children really are still very young. But I have a lot of friends who are pro-life feminists, and they would have marched for certain things.
Yeah.
They were literally excluded from that march.
Mm-hmm.
That is an example of something that actually happens a lot. And the excluding characteristic is always so-called reproductive rights, actually. So my point is that from the 70s and the 60s and the 70s, abortion has become sort of the sine qua non of the feminist movement for most. But you're saying otherwise, perhaps. It seems to be the case, but perhaps not. Tell us.
Like, from my point of view, actually, it's a very, very small part of what feminism is nowadays.
How would you define it?
Oh, I see feminism mostly as the effort of women try to achieve a more equal status in a legal level and a jobs level, so employment
okay.
level, healthcare level, as political level as men do. But personally, I mean, I feel more that, you know, reproduction is something that requires two human beings.
Yeah.
By default.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, that's an issue that regards men as much as it regards women. And I feel like a lot of people who talk about like reproduction rights
uh-huh.
are so connected to feminism. I feel like they're actually a very small, tiny, very loud minority.
Well, I think that's interesting. And this is good to know, because maybe it is a small, tiny, and very loud minority. I mean, I would not know this because I'm not a secular feminist. For what? No, for real, honestly. And then the other thing is, I'm an evaluator of theory and of text. I mean, that's my sort of principal, like, mode of engagement. So it is possible that, like, on the ground, your experience is really true. I don't know this to be the case. I do want to say this, though. Even from the point of view of, like, something like pay equity, political representation, and those things being sort of the primary thrust of the feminist movement, even if that's true, I do think the pro-life point comes in nonetheless. Because the people that were saying we need to pay equitably, which I'm all for, the people who need to be politically represented, which I'm also all for, are also the same people who happen to bear children, and who happen to bear children for 20 to 25 years tops. So, I mean, there is a sense in which we're not interchangeable. And so we have to think about, does equality look like I can do everything that guys can do and suppress the fact that I happen to be a childbearer? Or does equality look like I can do stuff that guys can do, and this has to make room for my capacity to actually have children? So I'm a professor. Professors try to get tenure. I mean, I don't know what I want to know about these things, right? And like, you know, it's a wonderful thing. I would be the first person to admit no one has dropped security like a tenured professor. I love that I'm saying this on tape. Watch, I'll go home and I'll be like, you know, we signed back to the theology department and, but anyway. So, I'm just saying, Murphy's Law. But so maybe I shouldn't say that. But a anyway, I'm a tenured professor. Now let's think about tenure. Okay, so the average person who's a professor goes to graduate school, and this is not in the sciences. So keep in mind, if you do something in the sciences, particularly like medical sciences, if you get like an MD, PhD, or something like that, we're talking about like way out there. But you know, it could take roughly like 8 to 10 years, maybe 5 if you're super awesome, but 7 or 8 I think would be more normative to sort of get your doctorate, get a position, and then it takes anywhere from like 7 to 10 years to get tenure. Now, you graduate from college roughly 21, your childbearing diminishes by 35 and starts to fall off a cliff by 42. Which means that the prime time when you have to do most of your productive, this is just an example, most of your productive work, write all of the things that you have to write, and be like the awesomest super special professor ever, is precisely coextensive with the time where you might have a family. So those of you who are women, I mean, you have to keep this in mind. This is like certainly, the, not just for professors, this is certainly the case. People expect you to be productive, super productive, right at the gate. Now, I tend to think that that's an example of a male criterion that's unnecessary. Why isn't it the case, why isn't it equally the case that a person can be extraordinarily productive from, say, 40 to 60? Why can't you do professorness, but in the way that the 40 to 60-year-old set kind of do, well, I'll put down an article here, there, have your children, raise your children, teach other people's children, fine, and then really pick up speed at the end of the childbearing years and go. That should be an equally reasonable approach. That should be an equally reasonable approach to this. So I just take that as an example. So I think my best interpretation, oftentimes, is that some feminists want to fix this problem not by expanding the criteria, but by diminishing those things that we do to try to get us to conform as much as possible to the other. That's my experience, though, but I respect yours.
That's really interesting. It sounds to me like you're putting a lot of the childbearing responsibility
on women.
Yes,
I am. That's the difference of thing. Okay, so like I have a husband who's a philosopher, which means that we have roughly the same schedule. So we don't ever have to use childcare because professors teach every other day. I know, dream job. Just keep in mind that like we don't get paid. So, you know, we're job security, and like we teach every other day, but we're not rich people. So, you know, weigh this with all of your like thoughts here. But anyway, so we work every other day. So my husband is pretty equitable with most things. But there's a lot of things he cannot do, which includes actually having children. Now, I have twins. So I literally had twins. I was teaching with twins, like Indy, which is a very strange thing, I'm sure, for all involved, besides me. Actually, it's probably really, women with twins are very, very, very large. I'm not a floral person, so we're talking about twins. I was like my own zip code walking into the classroom with these twins. I mean, it was a funny, funny thing, but anyway, the point is, we have twins, my husband doesn't nurse the twins. My husband doesn't bear the twins. My husband doesn't go to all of the appointments where you have to be like stress tested because you're having twins. You see, so there's all of these things involved that are what I call the givenness of being. So it's reality. So the thing is, like, I think it's more fruitful, not just from a theological point of view, from a practical point of view, it's more fruitful to think about just the realities of life. Women have kids. Men do not have kids. Men do other stuff. I don't go outside and play in the snow, because I don't like to be cold and wet at the same time. This is why I don't live here, right? So my husband goes outside and plays with the kids in the snow. I'm not ever doing it. I'm never, ever making a snowman. I'm okay with that. This is the givenness of my behavior. That's just my point. Okay, that don't get too far afield. But anyway, no, but all that having been said, I'm not actually arguing down. I think it's actually hopeful to me to hear that you think contemporary feminists maybe aren't fixated on the reproductive issue. This is not something I know from personal experience. So that's very helpful for me to hear. Yeah.
One question. I'll start on the way to catch up VR and talk about feminism in the Catholic community. So my question is, be or not be a revolutionary? And how...
To be or not be a revolutionary?
Yes.
Well, in what regard?
How you... I know most Catholics become Orthodox, which means not revolutionary.
Yeah.
Isn't that a school or a significant portion of Catholic women, men, revolutionary.
Well, I mean, I don't know how would you define revolutionary?
Revolutionary enough. Recently, 2015, Pope Francis calling for engaging all the cultural revolution, urging.
Wait, say that
engaging
what the
court
did you say?
Engaging all urging cultural revolution. But not many people have response
for it. Cultural revolution. I don't know what I think about that. I mean, that's such tricky ground there. Yeah, I don't know what I think about what Pope Francis just said there. Okay, no. I mean, okay. I don't know. I mean, here's what I think. I don't personally like the word revolutionary myself because I don't like the word revolt. Because the word revolt seems to circumscribe my action in the context of a reaction to somebody else. I don't prefer that myself. Now, when you talk about cultural revolution, I mean, I do think we need radical cultural change, even radical social cultural change, but I am a theologian. I think the change that we need culturally is a spiritual change and not so much a material one. I'm not saying there aren't poor people and we have to take care of them. I'm not saying that women don't have like all sorts of social issues, because we do. And we could just have a whole talk on just the feminization of poverty. But I am saying that I think our primary problems are spiritual ones. So I said at the end of the talk that I think we tend to get absorbed in material realities and we forget the spiritual ones. And I mean by that, we do tend to focus on the sort of horizontal dimension and we forget the vertical dimension between us and God. Now, I do think a certain rectitude of will oriented towards God solves the other problems. And so personally, I think any kind of change would start there. But I tend to think that's actually counter-revolutionary because that goes sort of against the more Marxist characteristics of those revolutions, including the French Revolution, which is pre-Marxist. Yeah.
I had a question. It might not, well, I have a pre-question and then a question. The idea.
That's all right, because last night I said at Harvard I wanted to give a pre-lecture before the lecture, because so one lecture needed a pre-lecture, so there you go.
So the givenness of being, and then you use the term specifically beingness as gift.
Yeah.
Is that a philosophical point, or is that sort of a theological presupposition?
That's a theological interpretation of the metaphysical point.
Okay.
Okay.
So I guess the reason I'm asking that, and that might not be as relevant if you don't see it so much in philosophical terms, but I think that's an area where a secular feminist would depart, is that even if we weren't created by God, so I think it was interesting that you had Simone did before,
yeah,
because Jean-Paul Sartre had imagined a situation, you know, I think it was the flies, where a man was created by God, but didn't mean God had any more rights over him.
Right.
Just because he was created, right? You created me, but you created me free.
Right.
Right.
That's
so, what's that?
I was trying to question, that's a good point. I mean, in other words, it's 3 points for quoting Sartre, but okay.
But the question in there, I guess, is, could you argue for that idea of givenness of being and gift? Right, because givenness of being just is, you know, the receptivity.
No, this is good.
But the gift seems to sort of, not be cheating, but sort of take an extra step in saying, like, creating something positive, like, okay, I've been given this thing, so I have, you know, I sort of have these obligations.
No, I think that's a really good point. Now, don't forget, I have to transition from our metaphysical, our ontological receptivity to our theological receptivity,
right.
And that was part of the transition, number one. So I'm not cheating, I'm transitioning. Now,
So, how would you argue?
Oh, how would you argue for the type of
gift that
okay.
we would have?
Well, the thing is, I mean, we have free will. Remember what I said was, yes, self-determination and self-expression are what I've determined to be the intrinsic principles of, that's my own analysis, the intrinsic principles of the feminist movement. But self-expression and self-determination are also part of the Catholic version within the context of freedom itself. So the question is really, are we talking about a kind of freedom that looks like a pure constructivism? And that's really what Sartre called for, as does Camus, you know, like a pure constructivism, or are there limits to the thing that we can construct? Now there are limits. Let me give an example. So if we think about what I said about act and potency, and remember that we said they should never put a chalkboard in here. See, they didn't do this at St. Paul's, so they were spared this. But if we think about what we said about act and potency, remember we said that this is the way a thing is, this is how it really is right now, in reality, and potency is what it could be. Now, the problem with the secular feminist as you and I have characterized it, but our friend in the back can always, you know, problematize this, is that they're confusing these things. Okay, so something is, something actually could be. Now, this is something, this is being. This is existence. This is becoming. This is the changeable part. Essence, as we call it later. There's something missing besides being and becoming. Do you know what it is? Anybody? What's missing? There's being, there's becoming, there's something else. Do you know what it is?
Bin.
No. That's potency. That's potency. It's changeable. Nothing. Nothing's missing. Not being. You're like, wait, what? No, okay, not me. You said there was something missing. There was something missing. Okay, so, not being. Not being is not rendered as act or potency. Okay, so, I have a red handbag. Now you know that this is a Catholic feminism lecture, because that's my example. I have a red handbag. Can my red handbag be green?
Sure.
Yes. I paint. Right? It can be green. Can my red handbag be mulch?
Yes.
Yes. I shred it.
I guess if that counts as mulch.
Can my red handbag be a dog?
No.
My red handbag is potentially green. It's potentially mulch. It has the capacity to become these things. But there's limits to what my red handbag can become. The limit is non-being. It is not within the potency of the handbag to become a dog. From the point of view of the Catholic understanding of existence, it is not in the potency of human beings to be everything. However, it is in the potency of human beings to be some things. That would be at least the rational argumentation I would use as an entree into the conversation with that person.
So you need to start with the Catholic assumption, right?
No, that's not a Catholic assumption. This is a metaphysical assumption. The Catholic assumption is to draw from here to specific claims about gender ideology.
Okay.
The metaphysical, purely rational assumption is that there's ways that things can be, ways that things are, and ways that things can never be. It's purely a rational proof.
I think it's at 8:30. I think it's a good time for the first to spend an hour and a half, and she'll keep going.
I'll talk to you. And, I really will. That's true, actually.
Thanks.
But we can chat. Thank you for having me.